Hi, welcome to One Foot in the Closet. I'm your host, Name Redacted, and I'm a queer, polygender African who lives life with one foot in the closet for reasons of safety, only out to trusted friends and family, but never publicly out in the Western sense, because to do so would be unsafe, as in the country I currently live in, it is illegal to be queer and anything but cisgender. In this podcast, I will interview queer Africans, both on the continent and in the diaspora, who live like I do, with one foot in the closet. Each guest has chosen their own pseudonym, as we are trying to create as safe and engaging a space as possible. I believe conversations like this are not only important, but necessary to help provide a counter-narrative to the predominant Western narrative of coming out. You don't have to have a bold public declaration to come out. You can exist with one foot in the closet for safety, like I do, and that's perfectly valid and deserves more representation. I would like to unpack the privilege of coming out through this podcast and how not everyone has access to this privilege. This podcast aims to give a platform to queer Africans to tell their own stories in their own words in a way that is safe to them. Today, we are joined by Abashese Azine. Welcome to One Foot in the Closet, Abashese Azine. Thank you so much for joining us and for agreeing to share a part of your story with us.
Thank you, Name Redacted.
You're more than welcome. All right, so I'm down to get into my first question for you, which ties into some of the discussions that we've had via emails and some of the things that you mentioned that you wanted to bring up in the conversation. And this generally tends to be my first question to all interviews is, can you recall your first or most significant memory or memories of encountering queerness?
Let me think. Okay. So when I was maybe 10 or so, that was the first time when I actually saw queer people on TV. So at that time, I don't think I really knew for sure. You know, sometimes you're just wondering if you want to be someone or if you actually like them. But that wasn't really, you know, in your consciousness. And also at the time, because of so much that was happening in the family, I had a pretty dysfunctional upbringing. So you always have a feeling that you're different from people. So that really extends also to the queerness, at least for me, it did. But yeah, I remember seeing queer people on TV, and that was my first time. And that was actually through my sister. And my sister had gone to college in the US. So when she came back later on when I was in secondary school, she was telling me about this friend that she worked with. And she was like, both of us had broken up with our boyfriends. And I was like, oh my gosh. Like, you're like, okay, so these people are not, you know, just some fictionalized thing on TV, right? They're real. Yeah, those were like the first experiences. But the first time I was in a queer space, that was when I was in university. And for the most part, I was just enamored by everything. It was all just new and I felt seen, even if I was not out at the time, even to myself. Well, you know, I didn't really accept it myself like that. Yeah. But yeah, those were the most significant. Oh yeah, one more was also my first time in a queer space in like on the continent. That was different. At the time I was out, well, not publicly, but to myself and some friends, that was the most comfortable I felt. Like I got in and my whole body exhaled. I was just, I don't know, like I got into the space and I was just like, my gosh. Yeah, there was just this feeling of belonging, even if I didn't know anyone at the time. Yeah, so that's it. Those are the most significant that I can think of.
Thank you for sharing those wonderful experiences. So you talked about your sister and her gay friend being an introduction to queerness in the tangible sense outside of TV. Because on TV, you see queer people, but you don't really know them on a personal level. But your sister actually knew this person on a personal level. So my next follow-up question to you would be, how did knowing that your sister knew somebody who was queer, who was open about it to your sister, how did that affect you and your journey with your queerness?
For me, at the time, it just made it real. It just made it real. But also the fact that the guy is white, it just also still seemed far away. Like, it was on TV, but still out of the culture, out of, like, so far removed from me. So I was not, well, I felt that, oh, okay, I'm not odd. I'm not, well, yes, I was odd, but I'm not alone in this. So that was great. But I didn't feel comfortable enough to, you know, talk to my sister about that or really anyone. It was one of those things, you know, where people are like, oh, that stuff is for the West. But at least, you know, you're not alone.
That stuff is for the West is a refrain that we've heard time and time again, that queerness is un-African, that, you know, all these lies that people say about queer people, because queer people have existed on the continent for centuries, and that's fact. But a lot of people use that narrative of it's for the West and it's un-African to demonize and cause a lot of hate towards queer people, unfortunately. And so you said that you experienced a feeling of it being real, but it still being outside because he was white, because he was from the West, because he didn't look like you and didn't have the same experiences as you do as a queer African. And then you mentioned your experiences in university and further on experiencing queer spaces on the African continent. So how did seeing people who look like you, who were queer, change your trajectory versus seeing somebody who was white?
So being in queer spaces on the continent, for me, it was like a hug. Okay, the first time when I was, because I came to uni in Canada, and even if I was seeing all of the things, and yes, there were Black people too in these spaces, it still felt like this was temporary, you know? I couldn't fully be here like, oh, well, you can do whatever you want, you can be whoever you want, but when you go home, you need to be yourself. You need to go back to regular programming. But being on the continent was different because it felt like everybody knew their culture. They understood the context of the situation we were in. And yet many people were just living freely, and not everyone, because there were some people who are only able to express themselves in that spot, in that place. But I felt this sense of belonging. I don't know how to describe it. I felt finally like I was at home. Like, so much felt temporary before. Like, okay, I'm back home, but you're not fully there. You're like, anytime, anytime, these people could just switch up on me if they find out. Or, like, you know, people you love the most. It felt like I shouldn't, like, make anything permanent or make any plans to settle or even friendships. You're just like, always wondering, once they find out, how would they react? And when they make homophobic comments, you know, I don't know. I don't, like, what will happen to this person who I perceive as my closest friend once they find out? Because you're not fully yourself if you're hiding this aspect of your life from, you know, people who you believe are your safe space. Yeah. But yeah, going there was amazing. It was a party. So, you know, people were dancing. People were all dressed up in drag, and we were just having a great time. I'm a very anxious person, especially in spaces where there are many people. So I wasn't, you know, fully letting go, but I was in the moment. I was super present, and I loved it. Yeah, I loved it.
That's amazing. I'm so glad that you're able to have that experience. It sounds like, I mean, the warm hug that you described it as, and the feeling of home, and like just being completely accepted for who you are in all that you are, you know, in all your multiplicities and every single facet of your identity. Because that's very difficult to find, because you'll find people who accept you for one part of you, you know, but don't accept another or don't accept another. And it's always difficult, especially, as you said, with the people who you love, who may be queerphobic, which is something that, like, I've dealt with and a lot of people on the podcast have dealt with. Having, you know, people who they love, people who are usually family or sometimes friends in their life who are queerphobic and who say very hateful things towards queer people. But you still love that person, you know, and that's difficult to navigate sometimes. And so having that space where everything can be open and everybody can express themselves sounds like such an amazing experience. And so I'm so glad that you're able to have that. And I'm very glad that you're able to experience that on the continent and that you're able to see that queer spaces do exist and that was able to affirm you in your queerness. So one thing that you mentioned while you were talking about the queer space that you went to is you mentioned that you felt like you could be fully whole there instead of having to split yourself into different, you know, parts of yourself. And one thing that you mentioned in your emails was how you often feel like in the past and throughout your life, you've had to split yourself and that you were used to existing as a fraction of yourself. You're used to splitting yourself and being whoever you are allowed to be, even if it was in opposition to who you were. So my question for you is, how did splitting yourself and being whoever you are allowed to be instead of who you truly were affect you over time?
Actually, the first time I realized that it was such an issue was when I first came to uni, because for the first time I had friends who I didn't have to be anybody else with, or rather a friend. Some of the other friends, you don't really show your full face. But yes, there was a time when I was lost because I just didn't know who I was. Before, I would just, you know, mirror what other people wanted at the time, you know, when you're in school, when you're at home, or like throughout high school. So I knew how to adapt to different situations pretty quickly. But in uni, for the first time, I actually had to figure out, I was like, I don't know what I like. I don't know who I am. I don't know in general. And maybe people just feel that way even if they were in spaces where they could be fully themselves. I don't know. But for me, that's what it felt like. I was like, I'm literally not anybody. I don't know who I am. So I started trying to figure that out. And later on, with this one particular friend, like who I've known since childhood, I recently came out to them, quote unquote. And we are so close and we talk about everything. But this particular part of my life, I just never talked to him about it. And one of his responses was that must have been difficult for you living a double life. And I was like, what? That's like my default state. Like, I always live a double life. I've never not lived a double life. It can be exhausting because every time you're on, you know, you're on, you switch on, you're kind of alert about places you can't go, things you can't say. Sometimes you catch yourself saying something and you're like, oh, mid-sentence, and you have to pivot. Yeah, but lately, because I work in a predominantly, and live in a predominantly white space, and I have to keep on switching personalities so much, I want to show up fully in my social life. So that's one of the reasons that I told them. I was like, I don't want to hide these aspects from people who I feel close to, because it's been exhausting. It affects your mental health. Also, you feel really isolated. And since most of the time that I am isolated, like actually, I do not want to feel that feeling even when I'm in spaces where I should feel safe and like I belong. And sometimes I'll tell myself, you know, don't catch yourself. Don't pivot from the sentence. If I'm talking about something and then, you know, it slips out and like, you know, sometimes I do see people react differently and it is what it is. Maybe it will get easier. I think one major aspect that has been challenging for me, at least, has been, if it weren't for my family, like my family of origin, I don't think I would have held out this long. Because that has been the main hang-up for me. Like, when one of my friends came out, his family was kind of, you know, they were hesitant and, you know, praying for him. And eventually, they accepted him. But for me, because my family was already dysfunctional, there's, like, already this obstacle that compounds the whole thing. So I'm like, if I come out and, you know, if they find out, I don't have a solid foundation. It's like pouring gas on the fire. Like, we're already dealing with this mess and then you bring something else in. But I do know that we'll find out eventually. and I'll just get across the bridge when I get there. But yeah, that is a major loss that I've kind of accepted in advance. It's sad, but it is what it is.
I'm glad that you were able to come out to your friend that they were able to see you, because you said that you were so accustomed to leading a double life that their question, you laughed at it because it's what you've had to do for your entire life. But being seen by them for living that double life and for, as you said, splitting yourselves into different people or being a fraction of yourself, you've had to do that for so long that for you, it doesn't feel like anything, whereas for somebody else, it might seem like this is a big deal. And I'm glad that your friend was able to support you through that. And I'm glad that your friend was able to be affirming towards you during that coming out, because sometimes when you come out, it's not as receptive. And so I'm glad that you had that receptive space and that you're being more authentic and that you're being more open and not cutting yourself off as much anymore. But I'd like to get back into your family. You've mentioned several times the dysfunctional upbringing that you had, and that's something that you mentioned also in our emails. And it was something that I'd like to get into because it's something that many queer folks can relate to. And it's unfortunately something that many people on the African continent can relate to. You said in our emails that you, like many queer folk, knew you were queer long before you accepted or loved that you were. You said that it initially felt like one more problem that had been bestowed on you to make your life even more complicated than it was. You feel that when you have more pressing issues, it can be difficult to grapple with your queerness on top of that. You had a very dysfunctional upbringing because of alcoholism and unresolved, unaddressed trauma. And first of all, I'd like to say that I grew up in a family where the extended family had a lot of alcoholism and unresolved, unaddressed trauma as a result on my immediate family from the alcoholism that had been passed down from my extended family towards my immediate. And it's a difficult, very, very difficult thing to navigate. So my question to you is, would you feel comfortable sharing more of your experiences with your very dysfunctional upbringing because of alcoholism and unresolved and unaddressed trauma?
So I grew up with alcoholic parents, and being upper middle class, it was very hush-hush. You know, but when we were kids, we didn't really know it was hush-hush. And I remember sometime my brother was just speaking casually and he said, oh yeah, he was reminding my parents about something. And he says, no, you were drunk at the time. And they just cut him off immediately. They were like, never say that word. So that's when we found out that, you know, drunk is a dirty word, you know. That's when we found out that this is something to hide. This is something to be ashamed of. When you're a kid, you think your reality is normal, you know, until you meet other people and they're like, okay, so we are not. Like when you go to school, because we went to boarding school pretty early when we were about 6, 7. And that's when I really started knowing that this, like, our family is not normal at all. When you hear people's stories about their parents, when you hear, you learn what not to talk about, you learn what not to say. So when they say, well, what did you do for the holidays? What happened? Like, you know, when people are recounting things that happened, you just learn to edit. You obviously don't tell outright lies because it's hard to keep up with those. But, you know, just cancel out the the other things. Yeah, so that's always been complicated. And because it's had really, like, it hasn't been consistently bad. You know, we've had highs and lows, but then there are times that where I can recall and I can say this was actually the worst time and compare it to another worst time and worst time, yeah. So dealing with that, where I was a completely other person, at least I had siblings who are kind of close to my age. So when we went to school, there were just things we didn't talk about. We usually stayed as close as we could to the truth. So what did you do for the holidays? Oh, we watched TV. We did this, we did that. But we didn't talk about the environment at the time, because sometimes it was just neglectful and that was the good part, you know? But sometimes it was straight up violence. So parents fighting, throwing stuff across the room and banging noises, doors slamming. And that's not normal. Yeah. So we always had that kind of, you know, we're walking on eggshells all the time. And all of us responded in different ways, you know.
Name redacted.
Got super religious. Went into Christian evangelism hard. And then Sam got super not. But yeah. I think there was a time where my parents did try to address these things, but only because, okay, I feel it was only because they had to. They were kind of doing it, you know, to complete the requirement or kind of performatively, but not really being honest and dealing with the stuff. Even right now, like, you can tell there are certain things you can't, there's certain lines you can't cross. Like, when you're there, there's this kind of tension where, you know, if you say something, it's going to be pretty volatile, you know, very quick. And yeah. So having to deal with that, it is messy. It is messy. And I'm trying to heal from all of that in therapy. I don't think my siblings are, even if I suggested, because there is always this sense that we have to keep their secrets. Like, for the longest time, I didn't tell any one of my friends until we finished high school and she was insisting on coming to my place for a sleepover, because she's been there before, because the rest of them said no, you know, they hadn't been there before. But she'd been there before because my mom dropped me off sometime and then took her home, like, to drop her off, so she knew where I lived. I was like, you know, she could just show up anytime. She's like, you know, I just need to come. So I just told her the situation, and she's like, oh, okay, I get it. Yeah,
thank you for being so open with sharing the alcoholism that your parents have dealt with and how that has affected. Because growing up under the roof of an alcoholic, I mean, it causes you to shrink yourself and split yourself and all these things that you have been doing just to survive, you know, because it's not a healthy environment. It's not a safe environment. It's a very, very dysfunctional environment to grow up in and to be raised in. So thank you for sharing so openly and honestly. As I said, I have experiences with extended family. And so my parents grew up under the roofs of alcoholics. And so as a result of that trauma that they experienced, they responded by basically becoming incredibly, incredibly anti-alcohol because of all the trauma that it had brought to their lives, which makes sense.
Yeah, my brother did the same.
So that actually gets into my next question. As I was wondering, how did your dysfunctional upbringing and the violence and the alcoholism in your home, how did that affect you and your siblings' relationships with each other over time? And how did that affect, like, their respective journeys?
Well, growing up, we're pretty close because we were the ones looking out for each other, you know? Those were relationships I never thought I would ever grow distant from. Like, we knew each other in and out. We were inseparable. The older ones looked out for the younger ones, you know? So I remember, like, later in high school, it was just me and my brother left at home, right? My younger brother. And I was explaining to my older sister that, you know, I think it's much worse now. And she's like, no, it's not worse. It's just that we used to protect you from it. And I remember that, like, when we were little, my older sisters would actively be engaging us in stuff, like trying to distract us or getting us away from the situation. And it didn't really hit us like that. And at that point, I was also doing the same thing for my brother. And I remember sometime he came back from uni for, was a holiday or something, and was like, you know, it was pretty bad, this is this. So I was like, actually, it sounds like it was the same situation that I experienced. It's just that I was shielding you from most of it. So yeah, growing up, we were pretty close. We relied on each other, counted on each other. But as adults, we've become distant, maybe in our responses to our upbringing, I don't know. But for example, my feminism is a big issue. It's one thing me and my siblings can agree on, you know, with feminism and Christian evangelism do not mix. And yeah, when I'm addressing patriarchal standards or something in the family, like when something is happening and you're like, I call it out and they're like, this is the way things are, or like, you know, corrupted by the West, or this. Even my sisters, some will be like, I agree, but you know, what are we going to do? It's just the way things are. You can figure out a way how to navigate it. Like, you know, you have to be the creative one to walk around the system, not dismantle it. So I feel less and less like we are as tight-knit as we used to be. And I do feel some of my siblings trying to hang on, like to pull things together and be like, we used to be so close, this. But there's something that happens when you grow up in such a situation, you become pretty good at reading people, reading situations, responding to them. So I could, in many, many, many cases, I could predict how things are going to go. And that would inform how I act or react to stuff to kind of drive it in the way that I want it to go. So even when the, you know, the LGBTQ rights conversation always comes up in Uganda, and when we are talking about it, I would always be advocating and be like, they're still human beings at the end of it. Like, you know, giving examples of stuff. And for a long time, I actually thought, you know, if I prove to them, because I was working really hard. I was working really hard, really burned out, doing the best that I could. I was like, if I could prove to them that I could be the best, then maybe they could see that, you know, all queer people are just people. We are no different. But eventually I just realized that they got more stubborn in their beliefs. Like, if anything, I would say they got more radical in that direction. Because, like, some of them even became Trump supporters. Like, that's how bad it is. And I just stopped trying. So myself, you need to get out of this. And luckily, I was able to. I had the privilege to take a well, to emigrate. So I did that. And it gives me time, it gives me space to figure out who I am, build community outside of my family, you know, my family of origin, maybe create a new family. Because it's really hard to make changes when it's type of toxic space. I mean, for the longest time I tried, but yeah.
You have to protect your peace and protect your boundaries at the end of the day, because you can try to convince somebody of your humanity, but if they don't see it, they won't see it. And at the end of the day, that's just exhausting you and putting a whole bunch of emotional labor on you for no result, because the person just refuses to see the humanity in you. And so I'm glad that you're able to protect your peace. I'm glad that you were able to immigrate and get to a safer space for you and to be able to start building a new chosen family. And I'd actually like to get into the immigration part of things, because one thing that you mentioned in our emails was you said that one of your priorities, once you realized how toxic of a space your family of origin and home was about getting the political and financial security for yourself outside of your family's reach. You mentioned that you're privileged enough to be able to pursue this, thankfully. And I've spoken about privilege on this podcast before, and how as marginalized folks, we have to use whatever privileges we have to get by, and we have to take advantage of those. But then you go on to continue by saying that you promised that you wouldn't betray yourself when asked, because you had been asked in the past, especially when you engaged in feminist debate. And this feminist debate ties back into the debates that you're talking about with your family, where you were talking about LGBTQ rights and your family was having these homophobic and hateful views. But you talk about being in feminist debates where usually not in good faith, because they were trying to figure out what your stake was in arguing for LGBTQ rights, was they would ask you, why do you care so much? Are you a lesbian or something? Which is a terrible thing to ask, as everyone should care about and fight for LGBTQ rights, but also terrible thing to ask, because it feels like to me that they're trying to out you in an unsafe space, you know? And no answer will ever be good enough for people like that. So, I mean, I personally say protect your safety and protect your peace. But my question for you is, how did it make you feel to be in feminist spaces that were not intersectionally feminist and not welcoming to all women?
Actually, the first feminist spaces that I was in were queer spaces. And that was mostly, you know, it was back home. So when I was getting into feminism, a lot of the feminists on Twitter, those spaces that were there curated, those were the ones that I joined or I attended, and they were queer friendly. I think it's when I emigrated, that's when it became the issue, where a lot of feminist spaces here tend to be white. So you actually need to go out and find a Black feminist space, and then, you know, you'll find queer people too. Because I remember even at my college, I went to this, it was like a queer social, and it was all white people. And then they were like, oh yeah, we should plan events, da da. And they were planning all these movie nights, and all the movies from start to finish were white movies. I'm just like, are you kidding me? But anyway, I have been in spaces like that. Like, you know, there's always the Libro that you meet, especially in this area that I live in, my Libros who are feminist. And I don't know. Like, also because I'm here, but I'm not here, maybe I don't feel invested in it. I don't know. I'm just like, I'm here, but only to get my things on go. On the continent, I don't know. I think I was just lucky to attend feminist spaces that were also queer or were queer friendly. I think the only thing is, you know, when at some point your friends start identifying as feminist because, you know, because we are women, but have zero feminist politics. So I wouldn't qualify that as a feminist space. So.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm so glad that you're able to find those queer feminist spaces on the continent, and that they were able to hold the intersections of queerness and feminisms and celebrate all aspects and all women, because that's very important. Because a lot of feminist spaces, as you said, are exclusionary. It's, you know, only white women or only cisgendered women or only heterosexual women or only, you know, a certain type of woman. And we need more inclusive and more intersectional feminist spaces. A lot of, unfortunately, feminist spaces don't think about other marginalizations on top of being a woman. And a lot of, especially white women, weaponize their womanhood in order to basically get what they want, which is very unfortunate. But during your previous question, you mentioned the African feminist Twitter, and you mentioned that that really helped you on your journey. And in our emails, you said that it especially sustained you when you felt isolated at home, and also during the pandemic, because you currently live in a white conservative town. And your time in this town is hopefully coming to end by the year's end. I'm keeping my fingers crossed for you that you're going to make it out. And I'm hoping that you'll have access to more Black queer spaces when you move. And you said that you also attended as many queer and feminist events as you could back home, so that you could just be in spaces where you felt like you didn't have to be so hyper-vigilant or disassociated to cope. So my question to you is, could you speak more to the sustainment provided by African feminist Twitter when you felt isolated at home and during the pandemic?
Yeah, if anything, that space really did save my life. I guess also because at the time I was still on Facebook, and, you know, Facebook is mostly people you grew up with, people you know, your family. And I was on Twitter for a long time, but I wasn't really on it like that. I got on it because at the time we just had to be on all platforms, you know, being a kid or not. But for the longest time, a lot of what I would say was, you know, careful and measured. Maybe it's just being a woman in Africa or something, or, you know, my background and having to be so careful in how I act. But on African feminist Twitter, people were just saying everything. Like, they were just speaking as if there was no filter between their mind and their mouths. And they were just literally saying my thoughts. So the couple of friends that I made on there, and that was wonderful. I think also we became kind of close there, you and I. Okay, both in real life and there, but, like, you know, it was like a duo thing, working both ends. But yes, African feminist Twitter definitely did give me the strength to get through and space to express myself or just listen to people say things that I was thinking, things that I didn't really have the language for, call out situations that I was struggling to articulate. Because I remember there was a time I talked to some of my friends. It was, you know, even just like feminist stuff, really. And I was addressing certain social dynamics in our group, and everything was like, the whole thing just went south really fast. Like, oh gosh. And then I see somebody on Twitter talking about the same thing, but it was articulated so well. And I was like, this is exactly it. But because the conversation went so badly, I didn't go back to, like, you know, address it in the group. It made me feel less guilty, because even if I was planning on leaving and, you know, distancing myself from this toxic environment and just being able to find a space where I can have, some tangible security, right? And I was still planning on keeping many of these relationships, many of these friendships with my family or my friends. Didn't matter how toxic they are. It just felt like I've been so with them for so long. I was still invested in maintaining them. I got an out with feminist Twitter. I was like, finally, here's a space I can make some friends as me. And I did. And yeah, it's also a great learning space. I learned so much from it. And because also in many ways, I was kind of blind because, you know, relating to class, like on some class issues, people do raise some points. And I'm like, oh, I didn't see that. So, yeah.
That's great. I'm so glad that feminist Twitter was, African feminist Twitter in particular, was able to provide you with so much solidarity, friendships, learning. I know that, like, one thing that, what's it called, is often said to me is that most people are a mix of privilege and marginalization, and it's recognizing that privilege that we have, and, like, holding ourselves accountable, using it for good, and recognizing that, you know, you can be simultaneously privileged and marginalized. It's not just all one thing. And Twitter has definitely helped me with, like, my growth, and especially because I'm disabled, and so disability Twitter has helped me with, like, solidarity of, like, the things we go through with doctors, the things we go through on the daily, the things we go through with capitalism. And I know a lot of people say Twitter is toxic and Twitter is this and Twitter is that, but I think it depends on how you curate who you're following. Granted, like, on my Twitter feed, there are a bunch of people who I don't even follow who pop up on my timeline all the time, which really annoys me. But, like, you can create your feed so that it's wholesome and that it serves whatever purpose you're trying to get out. And it sounds like African feminist Twitter really helped you through a rough patch. And so I'm grateful for it. And I'm grateful that we were able to.
Yeah, I hear that. Yeah. I hear that. Like, sometimes I hear people, like, I read tweets about a topic that I have not gotten into, and people are, like, talking about somebody spewing hate in some other space. I'm just like, I like this echo chamber that I'm in. I didn't even know what's going on. But yes, you get context clues and whatever else, because, you know, they're talking about it, but you're just glad that this person and all their people are just not in your space.
Exactly. The echo chamber can be great in terms of, like, affirming and just guiding you on your journey. I remember one time I tweeted out something that got a bunch of Trump supporters in my mentions. I don't know how they found me. But I saw all of them with their MAGA hats on, and they were all like, oh, like, you're just a freeloader. Like, you're just trying. And I was like, my goodness, how did these people find me? So I try to avoid all those spaces on Twitter as much as possible. But so my follow-up question to you is, you spoke about how African feminist Twitter and how it has sustained you. And my follow-up question is, how does being in queer feminist Black spaces, both in real life and digitally, make you feel?
Honestly, at home. Makes me feel like I belong. And I'm not actively reading the room. Because most times, wherever I am, I'm actively reading the room, you know, I'm on the whole time. But when I'm in these spaces, I just relax. Like, even if I don't do anything, even if I don't get engaged with anyone, because I'm very introverted, so it takes a while for me to get comfortable, get talking, and really depends on my energy at the time, but I'm just relaxed.
That's amazing.
I let go.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Like, I think that you deserve that on the regular, and I hope that you're able to find those spaces both digitally and in real life on the regular.
Thank you.
That you can just, yeah, let go and relax, because especially with everything that you've been through your childhood and through your upbringing, it causes that response of always being on tension because you never know what's going to happen. And you deserve to let go and to just breathe and just be in the moment.
Yeah. Thank you. I hope the same thing for us. For us both.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This was One Foot in the Closet. If you'd like to support our podcast, please subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And please take the time to leave a rating and review, especially on Apple Podcasts. It really helps. We'd love to hear back from you. Wherever you're listening in from, please share your thoughts with us via email at onefootinthecloset@gmail.com. Like our Facebook page, One Foot in the Closet. Follow our Instagram at onefootincloset, and follow our Twitter at onefootincloset. Please send any messages, thoughts, comments, and questions via social media or email. One Foot in the Closet was created by Name Redacted, hosted by Name Redacted, theme music by Annie King Smith, edited by Annie King Smith, mixed and produced by Drew Deacon Thomas. This project was funded by House of African Feminisms, a project of the Goethe Institute, Kigali, Lagos, and Johannesburg.